technology increasingly affecting every aspect of our lives, it's important to understand how it affects us psychologically. Welcome to the Psychology of Technology podcast, where we look at how humans and machines collide. Before we get going, just a quick apology for the sound quality of today's episode. We recorded it right in the middle of lockdown, and as a result, we weren't able to access the studio mics. Okay, hopefully it's not too bad. Here with you today is me, Kareem Tawansi, along with Brett Raven.
Kareem, 10 weeks into a lockdown here in Sydney. At least the weather is good. It's a bright, sunny day, and the springtime has come early, which is probably our only saving grace of sanity at the moment.
That is true.
Outdoors as much as we can, right?
It's so funny. We were so smug about the fact that we kind of missed the first wave, the first couple of waves, and watching everybody else on lockdown, and we were free and out there, and then suddenly it's hit us badly, and we really didn't know how to handle it. Although I heard that our premier indicated that we could be out of lockdown as soon as mid-October. So that would be exciting.
That would be exciting. Imagine the free-for-all that's going to happen at that point. The weather is starting to get really nice, and parks and beaches will fill up pretty quickly, and then we'll have a different kind of problem on our hands, I think.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. So today I thought we might talk a little bit about the concept of content, or what I like to call content is king. And one of the things that is obviously prevalent in our lifestyle is all the powerful machines and the latest software and all the great gear that we often have. But it does sort of beg the question a little bit, are we missing the point? Is all this stuff really of value, or is it the underlying value comes in the form of emotions? Because, you know, ultimately we are emotional beings, and no matter how sophisticated we think we are, our reptile brains still kind of drive a lot of what we do. We're still sort of focusing on that dopamine hit. So yeah, today I want to sort of play around with the relationship between technology and emotions. So to start that off, it's a little sort of conversation around the various sort of layers, if you like. And I remember, and I know you're old enough to remember this too, Brett, when hardware was the thing, right? Everybody was talking about getting the latest machine. But I feel like that's kind of something that's been really well addressed. And then do you remember through the 90s when the operating systems were, you know, getting the latest operating system was really cool, Windows 95, et cetera. And I think even that's something that's quite mature now. So these days, I think a lot of what is unique sits on top of the sort of the software layer, not so much the operating system, but the apps that we use, and more importantly, the content that they generate. So I'm thinking in terms of a pyramid, if you can imagine that content sits towards the top, and right up the top of that would be the emotion that we go through. So with that in mind, I sort of really wanted to talk about some of the aspects of how that impacts our personal life and our work life. You know, like, so everything that we do is driven by emotion, and the content that we work with, we generate content both on personal platforms like social media, but also on the work platforms, like if you're using, say, the Salesforce platform or the Microsoft stack. What do you think, Brett? What are your views on this topic of content and technology?
Look, I think it's something that comes to mind quite often these days, especially given the divisive nature of things like vaccinations, right? You have everybody's at home, everybody's stuck to their devices all the time, probably much more so than they used to be. And as a result, these mediums that we're consuming on a daily basis, social media, mainstream media, fringe media, tend to compete for our brain, for the lizard brain in particular. That's a good call out, I think. When you get people to react emotionally to something, it becomes addictive in nature, and we see this happening all the time, right? And we have a challenge here in society at the moment, because not only is content becoming the trigger point to try and gain our attention, you know, the whole, you know, discussion around attention economics, we become the product inside the social media channels. It's also creating such a division societally. And you've got these platforms that are effectively broadcast mediums that are really unregulated in many ways. Mm. They can produce whatever they want with very little in the way of recourse. And they put their hands up to say, you know, this is user content generated, so we're not responsible for it, and we shouldn't be treated like a broadcast medium.
So you raised so many good points here. One of the things I think about is the concept of tribes. I think that these platforms are enabling us to sort of find our new tribes, where once upon a time our tribe would permeate through every aspect of our life. These days we might find a tribe in very narrow lanes. We might belong to many different tribes. Some of them quite beneficial, and some of them maybe less so, without necessarily indicating what tribes I belong to. I can see how some tribes, from my perspective, are probably tribes that I don't really, not only don't want to associate with, but kind of wish they weren't there. But along the lines of what you were just talking about, this whole idea about the platforms and what they're enabling, and also whether or not they are responsible for it. And that's a really interesting topic in itself, because there's obviously a lot of outrage at many of those platforms. But the question is, ultimately, I mean, that they are very much driven by the advertising dollar. And even though the likes of Facebook and Twitter may attend to certain things which are obviously misinformation, a lot of those advertising campaigns that they get their revenue from are based on misinformation.
Yes.
So it's sort of a bit of a balance for them. But I think you were alluding to the fact that maybe this is something that should be regulated by governments. I don't know. What do you think about that? Should our government be regulating this for us?
So when you speak to people at Facebook who've been amongst the discussions inside the organization about how they should or should not be treated, they stand behind one thing very clearly, which is either we censor or we don't. And if we censor, then under what premise do we censor? So do we take an internal values-driven approach? Do we take a partisan line? Which tribe do we subscribe to, and which tribe do we allow to have a voice and to support? And I think it's a double-edged sword, right? I think if they go down the road of being treated more like a national broadcaster, for example, which, let's face it, they are a global broadcasting network. If you put a post up, it gets broadcast, unfettered and unvetted to many, many people potentially. If you go down that road, then the regulation would stymie the business model of Facebook. It would start to put a lot of regulation on content. The second you do that, then certain tribes will get up in arms and say our rights are being violated and so on. So it's a really funny place to be. And I think Facebook has really stood their ground on, we are not a media generator, we are a platform. And what happens on the platform, we really can't be held responsible for.
What do you think about that, what do they call it? That almost third party council that they've put together, which is ultimately still being paid for by them.
Yeah.
Facebook have, in their wisdom, have appointed a council of elders almost, who are meant to operate independently of Facebook and do the moderation for them.
It's a good idea, right? But I think any self-regulation is fraught, right? Any industry you pick self-regulation into, it easily becomes exploited or manipulated in a way that makes it look like they're ticking the boxes, but in fact, they're not really. And as an organization, I know Facebook has spent time putting in artificial intelligence to try and filter out the really nasty stuff that is obvious on the platform. They've done some good work on that space, but it's not necessarily the obvious and the immediately nasty messages that are out there that are being that divisive these days. It's a really slippery slope when you provide a broadcast medium and you don't have the ability to moderate in the way that they should be doing. But at the same time, over moderation becomes effectively, what it will do is drive people to the fringe. And when you drive people to the fringe, like Donald Trump's app that he tried to launch, which was very much a social media platform with zero regulation and zero, in my view, moral basis, that's where you drive people to. So if you take it out of the kind of middle main and push it into the fringe, that's when radicalism starts to come to play, in my view. So you talk about tribes. If you build a tribe and you instigate anger in that tribe, it takes a life of its own.
Yes, that's true. And hopefully the fringes stay in the fringes. As the question is, when the fringes sort of leak into the middle, so to speak.
Yes.
Yeah, look, I think it's a funny concept. It's one of these things that is a byproduct of the fact that we now can generate so much content. And that's because we kind of almost dock with machines, if you like. I mean, all the machines that we carry around with us, that we spend a lot of our face time looking at, as we are right now, all of this allows us to generate more content. It allows us to express more emotion. And, you know, the interesting thing is when you think about that and say, add something like Neuralink, you know, the Neuralink connector that Elon Musk's involved with, think about the amount of content that's being generated, especially if you apply Moore's law to it. You know, it's like doubling every 2 years. We're just going to have so much content, so much emotion. I think the next thing that I was thinking about is, how do we consume all this? How do we manage it all going forward?
One of the things that I was hoping that we could do as a society is to start to think about why we post, why we create these factions and tribes and so on. And, you know, I have people in my life that I would prefer didn't post as often or as somewhat radical as they do.
Yeah.
And I really want, you know, when I, before I don't post much on social media. It's not a generational thing. It's just a, I don't think you and I in our lives and our careers really want to put a lot of that stuff out into the public sphere, probably because of the, you know, the, we have the knowledge, right, that things just live forever and we don't want that.
Well, not personal stuff, no. Not
Yeah,
personal.
exactly. But I think a lot of people spend time not thinking about the consequences of what they're putting online.
Yeah.
So it could be something as simple as, you know, anything that you put up that's opinionated that may be divisive obviously tends to put people on the opposite side of that opinion off. And then you create emotion and create rage. And I think if people really thought about, you know, before they do every post or any kind of promotion of a post or retweet or whatever, think about why you're actually doing that. Are you just seeking personal validation? If you're doing that, then what's the point? You're living in, you know, you're creating a little echo chamber and hoping to get likes, and it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? You, the more you get into this cycle, the more dopamine hits you want from people agreeing with you and getting likes. And or the other, the flip side could be you post things that are controversial because you want to get into these online fights. And it's easy. You're, you know, you're behind a keyboard. You're protected from having to face somebody or even speak to somebody on device.
Yeah, see, I think that's just a stage in
I
humanity's
hope so.
progress. I think we're gonna, yeah, I think we're gonna go beyond that at some point. I'd like to think so. I think also one of the other things is with so much content out there, what's going to rise to the top is the content that is crafted in a way that humans can consume in ultimately a productive fashion. Because I think more of the world is becoming more productive, and there's a bit of a race for productivity. At the moment, the nasty stuff is getting an unfair amount of attention, but eventually, I think we as a species are going to move past that. So,
Well, I was just thinking if I hope I really hope that you're right. The problem I have at the moment is you can see generations coming up, like my kids, for example, 10 and 12. The sheer, you know, brain addiction that you can see, it's almost physical. You can see to devices and how, you know, they're on lots of different systems, some I don't even have visibility to anymore necessarily. I mean, I can track everything I need to, but you never know what they're going to say to a friend or what things get passed along. And if we get to a point where these kids are being raised as digital natives and they're used to consuming and reading content and being in these channels all the time, then that's going to be their truth. If we don't cut it off in some way, and really by example, in reality, if we don't cut it off in some way, I worry that we won't have that kind of reckoning. And it'll get to a point where we've created so many tribes that society starts to crumble even further. And, you know, there's documentaries and we've discussed things before about how social media has been the downfall of the last, you know, 3 or 4 years globally. The challenge is not just about the content too. I would say it's also, it's easy to automate this kind of stuff these days. And for people to seed bad ideas and continue to evolve those bad ideas because of the ability to measure people's reactions from it becomes a automatic problem in many ways.
I think one of the things we can do is equip our children with the right tools to deal with this. And I know that the school that my 11-year-old goes to teach them a whole bunch of stuff about digital safety. There are enough tools to keep our kids safe to a point, probably to at least age 13. But also on top of that, adding the right knowledge. We can't keep them
No.
away from it. I agree. It's such a big part. And now with homeschooling, they've got their face in a computer at least 2 hours of every day just to learn. So then when you add the other things they want to do, we're talking 3 to 4 hours of face time minimum if you're a good parent. So no, if you're a great parent. So anyway, look, but on the topic of learning, and you know, I'm just going to take this home for, on this point, which is one of the things that my child is learning at school, which I'm amazed with is storytelling. I'm just amazed how an 11-year-old understands the structure of a story. Because how many times have you been in a conversation when somebody's just jibber jabbering on, you know, where's the beginning, where's the end? Why am I wasting my time listening to you? I think the same thing applies to online content. When I think about the concept of content is king, it's not just any old content. It's well-crafted stories that have a value to the listener. You know, that's kind of my conclusion on this topic. But over to you for the last words.
So just if I again look at society in general and how it's reacting to the divisive nature of the content that's jammed in front of them on a constant basis. And if I look back and look at my kids and your daughter as well and thinking, what are the two things that we could do to enable people to be better internet citizens, if you will? I think the two things that stick out in my mind are critical thinking. So we really need to teach our children and remind people that critical thinking is paramount when you're presented with an overload of information. And the other one's resilience as well. Why do you need to react personally to something online? Why do you feel the need to be compelled? Why do you get hurt by things that are, you know, written behind somebody who's anonymous on a keyboard? So if those two things could be takeaways for what my children learn over the next decade in their life and really, really practice those, then I'll feel, you know, we're heading in the right direction as a society.
Well, with those very wise words, I'd say thank you very much for your time today,
My pleasure.
Mr. Raven. That was
My
actually
pleasure.
a very interesting topic. We'll see you at the
See
next
you soon.
episode.